And good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is educational, accessible, and fun. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my guest co-host, Jack Rubin. Our first guest this morning, Dr. Carrie Nugent, who has written Asteroid Hunters. What are asteroids and where do they come from? Most urgently, are any of these things going to hit our planet? Well, and is one on the way. Carrie Nugent is an asteroid hunter, part of a group of scientists working to map our cosmic neighborhood. And for the first time ever, we're reaching the point where we may be able to prevent the horrible natural disaster that would result from an asteroid collision. We look forward to our conversation with Dr. Hunter.
Good morning. I'm Jack Rubin. Our second guest this morning is Dr. Joel Green, who is a project scientist in the Office of Public Outreach at the Space Telescope Science Institute. The Hubble Space Telescope is a joint NASA and European Space Agency project and was launched in 1990 by the space shuttle mission STS-31 into low Earth orbit about 600 kilometers above the ground. During its lifetime, Hubble's been one of the greatest and most important science projects ever. We'll be talking with Dr. Green about his extraordinary space telescope.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio at KPCW in Park City. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Courtney Johansson, owner of 350 Main Brasserie. We are pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves contemporary American cuisine. We are open nightly at 5:30 p.m. Reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
I'm Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise grants and donations focus on youth programs and environmental initiatives that impact our local communities. Grants fund programs that are designed to help kids achieve in the classroom and develop an interest for the outdoors by engaging guests, local communities, and our employees. Information at epicpromise.com.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, proud KPCW sponsor of Cool Science Radio. Have you been told you need a total knee or shoulder joint replacement? Information about alternatives is available on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Jack Rubin, and I'm here with John Wells. Our first guest this morning is Dr. Carrie Nugent of Caltech IPAC, who has written a book called Asteroid Hunters, a wonderful tome. In Asteroid Hunters, Dr. Nugent reveals what's known about the impact of asteroids and what they've done. They've extinguished the dinosaurs. An Earth-sized hole was put in Jupiter by Shoemaker-Levy 9 just a few decades ago. And then there's the story of the asteroid that burst over Russia and almost started a war. And thank goodness we're not Ann Hodges, the only person we know who's ever struck by an asteroid in the U.S. Dr. Nugent, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, thank you. Let's start at the beginning. Can you tell us what an asteroid is?
Sure. So asteroids are often thought of as the leftover building blocks of the solar system. They're kind of the very early bodies that formed. And some, you know, asteroids kind of got bigger and became planets, and some just stayed asteroids. So it's very fun to study these things because by studying asteroids, you're really looking back in time and seeing the earliest parts of our solar system, what the solar system used to be like.
That's terrific. You know, as a guy who's not a scientist, when I think of an asteroid, I always worry about getting hit. You know, you hear about the one 60-some million years ago that wiped out the dinosaurs, ending the reign of T-Rex. Should we worry about mankind being wiped out by an asteroid hitting Earth?
Well, I've got some good news for you, which is there's been, you know, a lot of work looking for asteroids. And this is generations of work by many, many people. And in the work that's been done, people have discovered over 90% of the 1 kilometer or larger asteroids that get close to Earth. And so those 1 kilometer or larger are, you know, serious events. The one that hit the dinosaurs was about 10 kilometers. So we've found almost all of these really big ones, and we're definitely wanting to look for the rest. And we're looking for even now the slightly smaller ones. So there's a lot of really good work going on. And if this continues, we can really map our solar neighborhood and get a good grasp on what's out there.
Dr. Nugent, you had a fascinating example in your book about the size of a 10-kilometer asteroid. Can you take us through that?
Certainly. I love sharing this. So, you know, this 10-kilometer asteroid is what killed the dinosaurs. And I always had a lot of trouble kind of picturing exactly how big a 10-kilometer rock would be. And then I realized that 10 kilometers is roughly the cruising altitude of a 747 jet. And so what you can do is, if you're ever on a plane, you know, always get a window seat and look out and imagine a rock that's so enormous that starting on the ground, it goes all the way up to your wingtip. It's that tall. And it takes your plane a whole minute to fly past it. You know, this is a really, really big object. And when you kind of look out the window of your plane and look down and imagine, you know, kind of a sphere that big, you get a good sense of just how, you know, how damaging that could be.
Right. And many of the asteroids in our solar system or the known solar system, according to your book, are in this belt just beyond Mars and right before Jupiter. And I thought it was fascinating because my experience with asteroids is you know, watching these iconic movies, like in Star Wars when Han Solo cruises his ship into this asteroid belt where he has to dodge all these asteroids. That's not actually what happens in an asteroid belt, is it?
No, not at all. But, I mean, I do love that movie. It's an awesome scene, and it's I always think that the asteroids are the heroes of that particular movie because, you know, Han Solo is just getting out of the way. The asteroids are really the ones taking out the bad guys. But, you know, I think a lot of people have that impression of that's what the asteroid belt between our planet Mars and Jupiter is like, but that's not actually the case. So if you were to stand on any one asteroid in our asteroid belt and look out, you would probably see a couple asteroids, but they'd be very, very tiny and very, very far away. You wouldn't have these big chunks of rock flying around. In addition, if you were to take all of the asteroids in the main belt and somehow like squish them together to form a giant ball, it would still be smaller than our own moon. So there's not a whole lot of mass out there, and it's really spread out because space is really big. And it's always very hard to depict that visually. If you ever try to put this on a graph, you know, you try to plot the main belt asteroids relative to the planets, you always have to make the asteroids big enough that you can see them on your plot, which makes it seem much more crowded than it actually is. So, yeah, the main belt is kind of a different place than most people envision, and objects in the main belt stay there for millions of years. They have very stable orbits.
You know, Dr. Nugent, I loved your book. You take really complicated stuff that's kind of mind-bending and make it easy for guys like me to understand.
Well, that's so kind of you.
Yeah, no, it's a great read. You go into a little bit of detail as to how you find asteroids. You know, the idea that the name itself means star-like and that they look like stars when you look through a telescope, but the idea that they move more quickly relative to us. And if you could just go into a little bit of that, I thought the idea that you'd look through and you'd see these things popping out of overlapping shots was just fascinating.
Yeah, it's really interesting because your basic method of discovering asteroids hasn't changed at all for hundreds of years. It's the same method that they used to discover the first asteroid. Basically, you look at the sky, one portion of the sky, and you take a picture, or in the olden days, you draw a little map. And then you wait a little bit, and you take a picture of the same area of the sky, or you draw your little map, and you look for things that are moving relative to the stars. And those are your asteroids. And then, basically, we've just adapted technology to, you know, as technology's come along, we've used it to find asteroids. So we've moved to film. And there's a great story by Tim Spar, who's done this, you know, is a really huge name in the field. And he was doing this as a graduate student. He was taking these film images at this observatory that was like really cold, and they're like manually like shoving this telescope around, and there's like a loose wire that's shocking them. Like, it doesn't sound terribly pleasant, but like this guy really loves his work. And they were taking images and they were putting them in this special machine that would use the stereo capabilities of your eyes to look for these images that would move. So if you put the two film images they would take of the same portion of the sky at different times in there, your asteroid would appear to jump out at you, which is a very cool thing because Tim described it as something that really hooks into kind of like animal side of your brain, where, you know, it kind of has this excitement in you. And so sometimes he'll be driving along and see two streetlights, and one will appear to be like slightly in front. He'll think it's an asteroid. He'll get really excited, and then he'll just, you know, because it's so deeply ingrained in him, this searching for asteroids. These days, we will use CCD cameras like you have in your cell phone, but, you know, a lot more fancy, and computer programs to look for the moving images. So it's very computerized now, which allows us to really increase the amount of sky we can cover and the number of asteroids we can find.
And you also go into the idea of using infrared, the idea that heat might give you a better picture than visible wavelengths, and using what I believe was the NEOWISE telescope. If you could just tell us a little bit about that, that'd be great.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to. I love talking about NEOWISE. So There's five main groups of people that look for asteroids, and most of them use reflected light. So they're using telescopes on the ground, and they're looking up kind of classically like you'd imagine. And so that's really great and gets you a lot of good data. The work I do is kind of complementary to that, and it uses a space-based telescope. And we look at the heat that, as you said, that the asteroids emit. And this is really nice because asteroids can be dark as coal. They can look like, you know, they're just very, very dark. And as you can imagine, if you're looking for something that's as dark as coal against the blackness of space, that can be very difficult to see with your same wavelengths that your eyes use. So what we do is we look at the heat it emits in the infrared, and that allows us to find really big, dark asteroids that are harder to see with the other telescopes that are searching.
Dr. Nugent, a couple weeks ago, we had an opportunity to speak with Ben Reed, who's deputy director for NASA's satellite servicing projects. And on February 19th, on the 10th SpaceX commercial resupply mission, they put a device up in the air called Raven. It's a technology module that they're going to be testing over the next couple of years. It'll bring NASA one step closer to having an autonomous navigation capability. And further out, I mean, probably out in like 2030 or something, if this technology works, it has the opportunity to be involved in what they call asteroid redirection. Is that something that NASA is working actively on now, or they're just trying to test some technology?
It sounds awesome, but I'm afraid I'm not super familiar with that project. I'd love to look into it more, but don't have it off the top of my head.
Okay, I can send you some information on it, but it's
yeah.
It's basically a device that will be able to plot a course to an asteroid, and so that's the technology that would get whatever we have going to an asteroid there. But I don't know much more about it than that. But interesting stuff.
Yeah.
So I understand from your book that 90% of asteroids that are 1 kilometer approximately have been found, and the 100-meter ones, which are kind of scary, about 30% have been found. Are those numbers going up every year? Are we finding more and more every year?
Yes, certainly. And there's a lot of people who are working really hard to find all of those quickly. And just to be clear, these are asteroids that get close to Earth that we're giving these statistics for. But I actually have a website up in front of me that your listeners can also check. It's called minorplanetcenter.net, and they're the people that are in charge of keeping track of how many asteroids we found. And I can give you the stats for right now, but if people check this later, it's gonna, you know, they can check it again and see it go up. But right now we found, just so far this month, 88 near-Earth objects, so asteroids and comets that get close to Earth. And the all-time number is 15,911. And if you're interested in this, you can just check this webpage and see it go up every day, which I always love to do. This is a huge group effort by lots and lots of people working together to get a goal done. And it's really nice to see this kind of all of your work summarized in this number that keeps on going up every single day.
Yeah, and again, that's minorplanetcenter.net?
Yes.
Okay. You know, it has to be really exciting when you discover an asteroid.
Absolutely. I think a lot of times people have this impression that outer space is explored. And, you know, it's great. We've done a ton of exploration, and we have images of every single planet, including Pluto, whether you count it or not as a planet, from spacecraft, and you can see all these geologic features in it. It looks like we've got a good grasp of our solar system. But it turns out that, you know, we haven't even discovered most of the asteroids. And it's crazy that, you know, this exploration is happening every day. These new discoveries of asteroids that are, you know, in our cosmic neighborhood happen every single day. We're literally doing exploration now. And I think a lot of people don't appreciate that there's still so much left to discover. And the cool thing is, even though we've discovered a lot of asteroids, they're still very mysterious. We can't tell, you know, we don't have images of their surfaces. We don't know how big most of them are. And these are all like little tiny worlds that you could go and like bounce around in as an astronaut. So it's interesting to me just how much we have left to discover about our own solar system.
You know, one of the things that came out in your book, and also you have a wonderful TED Talk, is the combination of, observation mathematics that allows you to plot the orbit of these asteroids to a degree of precision that's mind-numbing.
Yes.
so the idea that, these things are whipping around out there like cannonballs ready to hit us, but in many cases we would know, years in advance whether something was coming our way. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's fascinating to me how precisely these things can be predicted. So in the book, I talked to John Giorgini about this. There's lots of people that do this work, but John's kind of funny because he does this work very precisely, but he's always kind of very calm about it. You know, he views things in a very analytical way. And so he'll say, like, oh, yeah, we got that one for 800 years. And I'll be like, oh, my God, John, 800 years? You know, that's insane. You know, to know where an asteroid is going to be for every single day 800 years in the future, it's incredible. But what it comes down to is that the forces that govern these objects are very simple and easy to predict. So you can predict where these things are going accurately in a way that you can't. Yeah, and that's unique in the kind of scope of natural disasters. You can't predict when an earthquake is going to happen to the day, you know, like 3 years from now. You can't predict when a hurricane is going to land, exactly where it's going to land, even 2 weeks in advance. But with an asteroid, since you know exactly where these things are going, you can really predict if there's going to be an impact or not. And that gives you the time to do something about an impact if one is predicted.
And the precision is critical, you know, whether an asteroid is going to be a glancing blow off the atmosphere or a tangential hit that might, you know, like just pop through and create mass destruction for an object that's, you know, hundreds and, you know, beyond my ability to estimate away. You know, the one that you talk about in your book that sort of glanced over Russia and exploded in the sky could have been significantly different if it had been a direct hit.
Certainly, certainly. And just to be clear, just so no one's worrying who's listening to this, none of the known objects are predicted to hit at all. Everything we found is
Thank
on safe trajectories.
but
yeah, it's true. The one that exploded over Chelyabinsk, Russia, was actually very small. That was only about 20 meters across, about as big as a convenience store. And it came in at a really shallow angle, which dispersed the force. But it did cause a lot of injuries. Fortunately, nobody died. But yeah, it is... you know, it could have been very different. It was also made out of rock as opposed to metal, and so that broke up a little more easy. I like to compare that one to the object that exploded over Arizona 50,000 years ago and created Meteor Crater, Arizona, which is a really cool place to visit if you guys want to take a road trip south. But that one was made out of metal and came in at a sharper angle and left this huge hole in the ground. So, yeah, there's a lot of variables involved in this.
And there's some big daddies out there. I mean, the Schumacher Levy 9 left a huge, huge impact on the planet of Jupiter. How big was that one?
You know, I don't have that off the top of my head, because I know it broke up into several pieces of different sizes.
Right.
I believe the biggest piece, I don't have that number off the top of my head either, but that was an interesting case because that was not an asteroid, it was a comet. And that means that it had some volatiles on the surface, so water, ice, or CO2, which asteroids don't have. And that was an interesting thing because it was predicted to impact Jupiter, and people didn't know if anything was going to happen because Jupiter is an enormous planet, and it's made out of gas. Maybe this thing would just pop in and just be, like, swallowed up. But, you know, just in case, astronomers did what they did best, and they turned every single telescope they had towards it, including some great observations made by Hubble, and looked at the planet and saw these big scars that appeared, including this hole that was bigger than the Earth. And there were these big dark marks that could be seen from backyard telescopes here on Earth. So it was a really dramatic event, and I think it really brought a lot of awareness about the damage these things can do and that this wasn't just something that happened millions of years ago. This is, you know, an active process in our solar system right now.
So I guess there was someone named Schumacher and someone named Levy, and they were credited with the find. How they found that, it just boggles my mind.
It was actually two people named Shoemaker, which is Carolyn and Jean, husband-wife couple, and then Joseph Levy was the third person. And,
okay.
Yeah, these people were, and this was kind of, they were one of the first groups of people that really searched for these objects, and they have so many discoveries to their name, like very, you know, once I got to meet Carolyn Shoemaker, and I was shaking. I was so nervous. I was like, oh, my goodness. You know, they're just giants in the field.
It's like meeting Mick Jagger, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much, except for more exciting for me.
I like that. Okay. Oh, God. You know, you mentioned that Shoemaker Levy 9 was a comet. And I was fascinated to learn in your book that sometimes an asteroid used to be a comet. But that the precipitation has burned off or has evaporated? Or can you talk about that? Because I get a little confused about what a comet is and what an asteroid is.
Well, you're in really good company because for a long time, you know, we had these two separate classifications. There were comets and there were asteroids. But there's been all these really great new discoveries by different teams that show that the line between those two things is blurring. So we found, and but that's like scientifically, I'm not involved in this. There was a great discovery of an object that was in the main belt, where we just assume are all asteroids, and it had a comet-like activity going on. That was a big surprise. There's objects that have orbits that are just like comets. Comets kind of have distinct orbits, but they don't ever have these outgassing. They don't have any, as you said, any sort of volatiles on their surface. And so the line is really blurring between these things, and we're discovering all of these interesting borderline cases, and people are coming up with great names for them. One of my favorite different terms that's popping up is Manx comets, comets without a tail, and that was made by Karen Meach, who's a big fan of cats.
That's pretty good. Could we just delve into a little science fiction here for a second? You spent
sure.
a little time in your book saying, gee whiz, we find an asteroid is headed towards us. There are about four different things we could do. We could try to use a gravity tractor to pull it away. We could try to blow it up with a bomb. We could paint it. That was the one I really loved. You could paint half of it black and half of it white.
Yeah. I have to be clear that the painting isn't being seriously considered. You know, there's... Just because it's hard to predict, if you would want to do this sort of mission, to move an asteroid, you would want something that's just incredibly controllable, that you have all the variables accounted for. But the fact that, you know, this is a kind of a dramatic event really, you know, sparks creativity in a lot of scientists. And so one of the more creative solutions is, you know, which is kind of fanciful that people are brainstorming about, not necessarily seriously considering, is to paint one side white and one side black. And then you use the different ways that, you know, white will reflect all the light and the black will absorb the sunlight and heat up and re-radiate a little bit later in the infrared. And that imbalance of sunlight can actually move it slightly. And this is kind of based off of a very obscure but really awesome thing that happens on asteroids called the Yarkovsky effect. And that, again, has to do with the fact that asteroids will get the most sunlight at their kind of local noon. But the warmest part of the asteroid day is kind of like 3 p.m. And that's the same thing on Earth. Like, you get the most sunlight and then takes, you know, the ground a little bit to warm up, and then you have the warmest time at, like, 3 p.m. And that imbalance of when you get your photons and you release your infrared photons acts like tiny, tiny rocket thrusters and actually moves these asteroids very, 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 very slightly. And that's been detected on a few asteroids, which is a really cool thing. And it's crazy to think that sunlight can move an asteroid at all. But it totally happens, and this was invented by this guy Yarkovsky in, I believe, the early 1900s, and he was actually a railroad engineer, so he was, like, working in the dirt, you know, with coal, and just in his spare time thinking about asteroids, and happened to come up with this great and totally provable theory.
You know, all this stuff has moved on a timeline that I think, in my lifetime, at my ripe age, has moved much quicker than I would have thought. So this idea of gravity tractors and painting asteroids and stuff to try to avoid a catastrophe in the future. If you were to, you know, sort of ruminate on that, when do you think that might be a possibility to actually happen? Is that, you know, decades away, centuries away, or just a few years away?
Well, I think that just to have the technology to move something, you mean?
Yeah, to actually do it.
Well, it's interesting because back in 1993, a group of experts convened and agreed that back then they had the technology. So I think certainly we have the technology now. It would be, you know, immensely expensive, and we wouldn't want to do it unless we had to. And so that's, but the thing is that, you know, if what we're doing now is we're searching for the asteroid, so that would give ourselves plenty of lead time to do something about it if there was one headed our way. The advantage to this is also that we could search the whole sky and figure out that there's nothing there that's going to hit us, and then we could just relax for a bit, which would be really wonderful.
Yeah. Hey, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, what was the Bruce Willis, Ben Affleck? Was that Armageddon?
Yes.
Okay. So when they landed, one of the spacecraft landed, it kind of bounced a little bit. And then I think Rosetta is a comet, or they think it's a comet, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Rosetta was the mission to Churyumov's Gerasimenko, which was the comet.
Yeah. When they initially landed on that thing bounced off the surface. Are these asteroids hard to adhere to?
Yes, certainly. The gravity is so low. Kind of on an average asteroid, an average human being weighs as much as a cell phone. So there's not a lot of gravity sucking you to the surface. So there's a lot of bouncing going on, and it would certainly be very difficult to maneuver around one of these things.
Yeah, so how do we get around that?
That's a great question. And I think there's a lot of smart people looking at that, but I think it would be tremendously difficult for an astronaut to move around or a robot to move around on an asteroid. I will say that the mission Hayabusa 2, which is a Japanese mission, is headed to the asteroid Ryugu, and they're going to have a rover on the asteroid. And I am just dying to see how that goes. I think it's going to be totally awesome. I'm so excited to get the data from that and see what everyone discovers.
Why do I have this feeling that you want to drive that rover?
I wouldn't say no, but I'm not involved in that mission, so I'm just going to be cheering for my friends who are.
The book is Asteroid Hunters, Dr. Kerry Nugent, who also has a fascinating TED Talk. If you want to Google Kerry Nugent TED Talk, you have a lot of enthusiasm in that talk as well, and minorplanetcenter.net if you want to stay appraised of asteroids that are being discovered. We want to thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Okay. Thanks. We shall return in just a couple of minutes right after these messages.
This is Angela from Peak Art and Frame, sponsors of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Peak Art and Frame offers local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framework, and mirrors. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We're just speaking with Dr. Kerry Nugent, who has written Asteroid Hunters. Our next guest is Dr. Joel Green, who's the project scientist at the Space Telescope Science Institute. The Hubble Space Telescope is the largest, most complex, and most powerful observatory ever deployed in space, designed to allow astronomers to look far back into our own cosmic past with unprecedented clarity. She is the rock star of all telescopes, the Hubble, and with 27 years in space, this heavyweight champion can still throw a punch and inspire people of all ages. Dr. Green, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Dr. Green, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, okay. Great to have you. Let me start with this. What does Hubble mean to you?
Well, the Hubble Space Telescope, as you said, it's the longest serving space telescope, and it's one of the first. It's sort of the telescope that I was a kid when it launched, and this telescope brought these images of the sky to just new depths, things people had never seen. I think it plays sort of it's invaded our imagination in pop culture. If you look at movies from before Hubble, you know, the sky backgrounds in science fiction movies are always just stars. And now you look at modern movies, you see nebulae, galaxies, beautiful swirls of things. So I think it's had a huge impact on just the way that we perceive the universe.
And of course, these pictures have been inspiring, and they're just extraordinary, and they've helped us understand and look back into time. But what are some of the cosmic mysteries? What actual hard science has Hubble helped us to understand?
Well, where do I begin? Hubble has essentially revolutionized every aspect of astrophysics and some other areas of physics as well. And so to draw just a few specific examples, Hubble has found the most distant galaxies, the galaxies right, you know, as far back in time as we can look before they their light shifts into wavelengths we can't see that Hubble can't see. So it has found galaxies up to 13.4 billion years in the past. And that's getting pretty close to where the very first stars and galaxies turned on. And so it's helping us understand, because of light travel time, so the farther you look back, the more back in time you look. And this is helping us understand sort of how the universe has evolved and changed throughout time, when stars formed, how they were born, how that process happens, and how you end up with galaxies and more, you know, let's call it modern solar systems like we have today. Hubble has also revolutionized our understanding of, it's been able to analyze atmospheres of planets in a few cases. And it was actually the first telescope ever to detect the gas in the atmosphere of a planet around another star. And it's also contributed to our own solar system. It has made some really interesting discoveries on Jupiter's moons, for example, that I can go into a little bit more detail on. But basically, it's been discovering subsurface oceans. So it has contributions right here at home.
Dr. Green, I would think that one of the greatest contributions that the Hubble has made is making people humble. You take a look at the pictures, the images are terrific. I looked at the Sombrero Galaxy. And then, you know, to understand this 50,000 light years across, 30 million light years away, a mass equal to 800 billion suns. I mean, this is all stuff that, for guys like me, is kind of hard to even put into context. How do you guys deal with that?
Well, the Sombrero Galaxy is this edge-on galaxy. So you say it's 50,000 light years across, which is really interesting. And even more amazing is how thin it is. It's probably only about, 500 or maybe it's 1,000 light years tall. So and this galaxy is much like our own Milky Way. So we're sort of, it's as if we could to actually leave our own Milky Way would take millions of years. So we can't do it, but we can get a glimpse as to what it would look like from the outside by observing these island universes around in other galaxies. And so the Sombrero sort of really starkly shows you just how thin and disc-like the Milky Way galaxy is, which is kind of amazing. And it helps us study our own structure by kind of looking at other case studies. I actually think the most majestic picture of a galaxy is called the it's this gigantic mosaic of the Andromeda Galaxy. Andromeda is our nearest neighbor. It's about only a few million light years away, and it's about the same size as the Milky Way, maybe slightly bigger. And we took a 400-picture tile image of it with Hubble. So this took a lot of time. And it was able to sort of map out about one quadrant of this galaxy. And you can look at this image online, and it's amazing. And what happens is if you look in more and more detail, you start to realize that all the little things you thought were little specks of noise are each individual stars. And that they're, you're seeing hundreds of millions of resolved stars in perspective in front of you. Each one of those, we presume, holding a planetary system. And it kind of gets you thinking about, boy, there's a lot of places out there to go.
Right, right. And there's a reference in reading about the Hubble ultra deep field work, where it talked about seeing into peering into the forest reaches of the cosmos. And then there was an allusion to the expansion of the cosmos and the expansion of time. And you lost me there.
So the deep field, so the idea here is, what happened was in 1995, I think it was, we actually pointed Hubble at what appeared to be, to any ground-based telescope, to be a blank patch of sky, because there was nothing, there's no stars in this field, there's nothing there, and so, we wanted to know what was hiding out there. And so if you stare at a field for long enough, right, you collect more and more light over time. If you sort of imagine exposing a camera in a dark room for a long period of time, you start to pick up details. And gradually, over the course of days, 10,000 galaxies came into view. And this field is tiny. This is just the size of a drinking straw held at arm's length. So it's a very tiny picture. That's what one Hubble picture size is. But these 10,000 galaxies popped up of an area that presumably had nothing. And with a few other fields, we were able to determine that this is true in any direction you look. And when we realized that, you know, galaxies are expanding out in all of these directions, and they're all sort of Doppler shifted. So that means that their frequencies are lower than they would you would expect if they were standing still, kind of like a siren in a car driving away from you. Then that means that since they're all expanding in all directions away from us, that the entire universe is in fact expanding. And the discovery of the deep field was that not only is it expanding, but it's accelerating. So it's actually speeding up the farther away it is. And that means that there's an extra force that we don't fully understand that's causing the repulsive expansion of the universe. And that's sort of where the theories of dark energy come in.
There are so many extraordinary pictures, and I've been looking at them over the years, you know, since the very beginning. And certainly the one that that caught my interest the most was the deep field south and then deep field north, and then recently, I think it was in 92, the ultra deep field. And I wanted to ask you, as I look at those galaxies, I mean, I know what a spiral galaxy looks like, and I know what happens sometimes when a couple of galaxies collide and you get these elliptical galaxies. These ancient galaxies look slightly different in some ways, but I can't put my finger on it. They just look a little different. Are they different looking?
Yes, ancient galaxies do look a bit different. By the way, the ultra deep field was in 2012.
2012,
not 1992. Yeah, so it's more recent than the regular deep field. So we keep going deeper, basically. So it gets a cooler name every time. so these ancient galaxies. So what happens is you look back. So the spiral arms, right? You know, we think of it as galaxies as these sort of organized spirals. But in fact, many galaxies are elliptical, as you say. That means sort of a big, more disorganized cloud or a blob. And so we have both of those types of galaxies. But what happens when they crash into each other is they create all sorts of exotic shapes, and galaxies frequently do run into each other. In fact, we are on a collision course with the Andromeda Galaxy in only a few billion years, so watch out for that. The stars, of course, don't hit, but the stuff inside the stars, the gas and dust, that all impacts and throws things around, and gravity interacts, and it breaks up and creates crazy shapes. But that all happens in our local universe, you know, now. So, but that's been going on for billions of years. If you look back in time, and therefore in distance, at the more distant galaxies, you do notice that they look a bit different. They look usually, the most typical thing you'll notice is that they're more centrally concentrated. In other words, there's more stuff in the middle. They're much more compact than modern galaxies. Galaxies spread out over time, or either because of natural flow or because of the collisions themselves. It's not entirely clear what causes all of this change. So one of the big debates in astronomy is what is the importance of these collisional interactions versus just the evolution of a galaxy on its own merits without running into anything. And then there's the role played by the interstellar intergalactic media and the stuff in between the galaxies that where a lot of the gas has escaped to.
Mm. Now, optically, we're never going to be able to see any further back into time. I mean, the Hubble Deep Field will take us 13.2 billion years into a 13.7 billion year old universe. So it'll be the future satellites that have the infrared capability, maybe on James Webb, that will be able to allow us to study those ancient galaxies in infrared?
That's absolutely right. And, they're also galleries. They're beautiful. But I should point out, of course, that the other thing that happens is you go back in time, galaxies start to look redder and redder and eventually become infrared and therefore not visible to our eyes or to Hubble. And so you need something that's more infrared sensitive. Infrared is like heat. So we actually have infrared eyes. Our skin is, in some sense, an infrared eye. You feel heat on your skin. You just don't see it with your eye. Well, we built a telescope that's even bigger than Hubble, called the James Webb Space Telescope, which is launching in October of next year, 2018. And that telescope will be the most sensitive telescope ever for infrared light. And all those galaxies that are currently dropping out of Hubble's field of view, not because Hubble isn't sensitive enough, but because it can't detect infrared enough of the infrared light, those galaxies will be right in James Webb's wheelhouse. And the question is, if you keep looking back in time, we know at some point there were no galaxies and stars, and everything was actually dark. And then before that was the cosmic microwave background, which you may have heard of, the image across the entire sky. The cosmic microwave background was about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. The Dark Ages must have ended before the first galaxies that Hubble is seeing, so that's 400 million years after the Big Bang. So somewhere between 380,000 and 400 million years, we should see the very first stars and galaxies, and James Webb should actually find those. And so they'll start to look presumably even more and more ancient until finally they're gone as you look back in time. And so this is going to be a really interesting experiment. No one knows what the answer is. And that's, I think, one of the many reasons that we're really excited about the James Webb.
That's unbelievable. In looking at this, the stuff on the web, the pictures and the images that you guys have posted, the things that look most beautiful to me, I like galaxies fine, but the nebula are just incredible. You know, I took a look at the Pillars of Creation. I think we're going to have that on our website today, KPCW. There are a few others that they're just beautiful. There's no other way to describe them. And in researching them, for me, you know, the idea that, you know, there really is no vacuum in space, but there's stuff out there, and it seems like you're able to pick that up, and it's just artistry.
It's amazing, and if you read my mind, if I were to pick my favorite Hubble image, it would be the Pillars of Creation. My research area, because I'm an astronomer, I focus on the formation of star and planetary systems, new stars and planets. Stars and planets are being born, even in our own Milky Way galaxy, all the time. And they're being born in places kind of like the Pillars of Creation, big clouds of gas and dust that are gradually clumping together under their own gravity. And what sculpts the pillars, what's really interesting is if you zoom out from that picture of these amazing columns of gas, and you look to the, let's say, you look to the upper right, you will see a bunch of very powerful stars that are fully formed that are blasting the pillars with high energy stuff. And that is blowing back these pillars. So these pillars are actually, if you've ever, let's say, put your hand through sand on a beach and you pick up sand on your hand, and it slowly, as the wind picks up, it will blow the sand backwards. And the little fingers that hang on, those persistent sticking parts, that's that dense stuff or that sticks to your hand, that's actually the shape. That's what sort of sculpts these pillars. And then inside of them, as they compress, stars are born. And we can see them peeking out just a little bit in the Hubble images. But if you look at them, the Hubble images, you'll see that there's this big gas thing, and it's blocking the light from the stars behind it. Whereas if you move to the infrared, you would see through it or into it to analyze the dust and gas that's making these stars and these new planetary systems that are being born around all of these stars. So the Pillars of Creation is one of the most majestic images I've ever seen, but it's this fascinating story of creation and destruction inside these pillars of new stars and planetary systems.
So to follow up on that, the second place winner was the butterfly, a dying star, as you say, you know, looking at the evolution of the cosmos, and, you know, spewing gas, and, you know, once again, the numbers are mind-boggling, you know, temperatures of 20,000 degrees Celsius going at 950 kilometers per hour. So that's sort of the end of the cycle.
Per second, I think.
I think you're right. Sorry about that. Yeah, it's orders of magnitude I don't quite get. But yeah, but it's beautiful art at the same time. And by the way, it's only 3,800 light years away, you know.
What's interesting is the death of stars is so dramatic and so beautiful and not very long-lasting either. These are sort of temporary things. You know, these structures will gradually fade away into the galaxy's medium. And it's just the most amazing. All of the planetary nebulae and all of the supernovae and the remnants and things like that, they create these amazing structures. And I think what makes them most amazing is they're not just simply symmetrical explosions. They're not just sort of expanding spheres. They create exotic shapes like the butterfly nebula, this sort of butterfly shape, because of the very complicated stuff that's going on just at the very center where that star is collapsing in a very not random way. And what's interesting is that tiny little changes at the very middle, which we can't even resolve, result in these crazy shapes on large scales. And over time, they turn into beautiful things and then eventually fade away. But what the poetic part of this is that this is essentially the star's gut being removed and blown out into the medium of the galaxy. And the star has created all sorts of new heavier elements that were not there by burning its energy throughout its lifetime. those elements then seed these clouds. So all of these clouds of gas and dust then get extra elements, which then actually make it easier to form stars and planetary systems. So all of the heavy metals that we inherited on Earth came from previous generations of stars forming, blowing up, et cetera. And it's just kind of amazing to think that it's sort of life cycle dust and gas, and it just keeps getting restored. And so we in some sense benefit from the previous generations of stars.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Joel Green, who's project scientist at the Space Telescope Science Institute. Dr. Green, I believe that's in Baltimore?
That's right.
Okay. What was the duty cycle of Hubble? Was it like 14 or 15 years?
The duty cycle, I'm sorry, what do you mean? You mean how long between the maintenance missions?
How long was the mission supposed to last?
Yes, Hubble was originally planned to be, I couldn't say exactly, but I would guess about an eight-year mission.
Okay.
I believe it was, in the late 90s, I think it was supposed to work from about 1990 to 1997 or 98, something like that. But because of the partnership with the shuttle program and the fact that many parts have lasted much longer than it was originally expected, the mission has continued to this day. There have been five different servicing missions to essentially upgrade the telescope. It's not really repair. It's more of an upgrade. And so the instruments that are on Hubble now are actually quite a bit more powerful than the ones that it launched with. It's gone through three wide-field planetary cameras, for example. The image of the Pillars of Creation from 2015, is actually twice the resolution of the image that was famous on the postage stamps in 1995. And you'll notice the difference. The field of view is also a little bit bigger.
Exactly.
You can compare the two.
And also, 20 years ago, you put the STIS package on the telescope, which it was a camera with a spectrograph. It separates light into all of its different wavelength colors. But it also allows you to understand how old and how far away the object is. I mean, what was the value of the STIS?
Yeah, so absolutely. So one of the people may not realize there are multiple cameras and instruments on Hubble, and they get changed out, in each of these missions. And so a telescope is sort of an ensemble of science experiments. And so the STIS spectrograph, the STIS instrument, STIS. Space Telescope Imaging Spectrograph, I believe it stands for, was installed on the second servicing mission in 1997. So that this is the 20th day of that instrument on Hubble, which is kind of amazing to think. And that instrument has many different capabilities. It actually can do a whole swath of different experiments, ranging from ultraviolet light to visible light and even a little bit into the infrared. In my opinion, the most exciting thing that STIS has done, and there are many, is the very first discovery of gas around a planet around another star, HD 209458. And that planet, so it measured the sodium in the atmosphere of that planet. That's the first time that had ever been done. And what's really interesting when you think about that is when Hubble launched in 1990, we had not ever seen a planet around another star. The very first planet around another star was discovered in 1995. So at that point, it was science fiction to do the very experiment that Hubble did 20 years later. And so Hubble, was able to do science that didn't even exist as a field when it was launched. And we expect the same thing will probably happen with James Webb.
What's going to happen to Hubble after Webb goes up? Is attention going to be shifted? Will resources be shifted? It sounds like Hubble's kind of a living experiment that needs updating and upgrading from time to time. Will it continue to be a valuable resource, or will the focus shift to the new satellite?
Well, so the good thing about James Webb and Hubble is they actually do very complementary experiments. There's almost no overlap between the two. And so any experiment that James Webb can do is different than anything that Hubble would be doing. So Hubble is funded to continue operations through at least 2021. It actually is in the best shape of its entire existence right now. It's working extremely well, including all of the instruments on it. And so there is absolutely no reason to think that it won't continue as long as we possibly can with it. There is no replacement for Hubble that's out there immediately. Hubble is, because of its position above Earth's atmosphere, it has so much more, it has many advantages over telescopes from the ground. And so there are many experiments that still Hubble is the gold standard for. And that's going to continue for the foreseeable future. And so what will happen is we'll have to start, you know, thinking about new ideas. But there are other telescopes that will go up, and they will perform experiments that will sort of follow on many of Hubble's discoveries. But the Hubble operation should continue, you know, with any luck, for quite a while, just depending on how the spacecraft does. As you know, we can't get back to it or repair it now, so there's a little bit more of worry if something actually stopped working. But that doesn't look likely right now. And the last servicing mission was it was in 2009, and it was a wildly successful servicing mission. So in some sense, Hubble is only an 8-year-old telescope rather than a 27-year-old telescope because of the last servicing mission.
Yeah. Well, the Hubble has a 2.4-meter mirror, and the JWST, James Webb Space Telescope, is 6.4 meters, so it has 7 times the collecting area for, I guess, optics. But does that also apply to infrared, that its collection area is stronger for infrared as well?
Yes, it applies exactly the same way. So, in fact, James Webb can technically do a little bit of optical. So in that small overlap region, James Webb is 7 times more sensitive than Hubble in some ways, in that small overlap region. And so what's interesting is, but for the infrared, it's the only one that can do it. Now, there is actually a currently operating much smaller infrared telescope called the Spitzer Space Telescope, which is has been up there since 2003. And the collecting area of James Webb will be 50 times greater than that telescope.
Right.
So
right.
The improvement on that will be, you know, enormous. And so it's almost a better comparison at that point. So what that collecting area does, if you think of telescopes as sort of buckets that collect rainwater, if you had a bigger, wider bucket, you would collect more rainwater in that area.
Right.
A deeper bucket, and you would have more sensitivity. You could store more. And
now,
so that bucket is really big in the case of James Webb.
Yeah, and Hubble's
the biggest ever.
Yes, and Hubble's hanging out in a low Earth orbit, and I believe that JWST is going to be, I think, 4 times further than the Moon is from us, about 1 million miles. Is that for less noise?
That's exactly correct. It'll be about 1 million miles away. It is for less noise in a sense. So if you think about it, it's a heat-sensing telescope. So that means infrared is heat, is part of that is heat. And so you don't want to detect yourself. So you have to keep yourself cool. How do you do that? You have to get away from the heat sources. So you have to get away from Earth, which is this blindingly bright infrared source, you know, good for us. Doesn't affect Hubble as badly as it does James Webb. So it's more important to get James Webb away. But the other thing that was really key was to keep the sunlight off the telescope. And we were able to launch it into a place 1 million miles away. It's a very specific place called the second Lagrange point where there's no net gravitational force. And it can stay there, or at least in an orbit around it. And the way James Webb is built, and the reason it looks so strange, is that it sits on this sun shield, which is sort of a giant umbrella. And it always is pointed so that the sun shield is between, it blocks all of the light from the sun, Earth, and Moon on that side, and only lets 1/1,000,000th of it through. So the telescope stays cold without actually having to be encased in a tube. But that means you have to have them all in the same direction. And that stable gravitational point follows the Earth-Moon system around the sun at all times. So it will always be able to block those three out together. So that point was selected because it's really the best point that you could be at in space to execute these observations without having to build a tube around the telescope, which would be very expensive for such a large telescope like James Webb.
So it's sort of in a permanent eclipse.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, but Dr. Green, thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
Great. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. And folks at home, if you want to go to Hubble Pictures, you're going to have a lot of pictures to look at. We shall return right after this message.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
And we want to thank our guests, our sponsors, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Davidson Orthopedics, Nexus IT, and the Natural History Museum of Utah and Park City. You're listening to KPCW in Park City. And Jack, I want to thank you for joining us this morning. Had a lot of fun.
JW, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, good conversations. NPR National News is next.